You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the September 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of this month's cover story, Keys to the Kingdom, by Chris Heath. Hamilton's close friend, Melody Hobson, was also in Abu Dhabi that day. Hobson is a hugely successful business leader, the current chairwoman of Starbucks, and soon to be part owner of the Denver Broncos. She first met Hamilton when her motor racing enthusiast husband-to-be, George Lucas, took her to the Monaco Grand Prix in 2007, telling her how a rookie black driver had just broken into the top ranks for the first time in the sport's 70-year history. Hamilton considers Hobson a big sister, a mentor, and generally one of the most inspiring women I've ever met in my life. Part of what they share is the experience of what he describes as being the first and only one to achieve what they've achieved. We've bonded over that, Hobson agrees. I remember he gave this interview with Gayle King on the CBS Morning Show a couple of years ago, and he said, "Being the first and only black anything is a proud and lonely walk," and I literally stopped. I had chills and sort of welled up. I knew exactly, proud and lonely, it's how it feels. Hobson had not told Hamilton that she and her husband were coming to Abu Dhabi, and they were carefully kept out of his sight the whole weekend. George kept saying to me, Hobson explains, "There's nothing worse than when you're in the last days of your movie and you're totally behind and your family shows up. It's the worst." But after what Hobson characterizes as the horrible act, she and Lucas saw him. "He's really stunned," she remembers. "Stunned, like shock. He's asking the same question over and over again. What happened?" I grabbed him by both shoulders. I was like, "You did everything right." I kept saying that to him. I said, "It wasn't you. You did everything right." And he just literally said, like four or five times, "What happened?" Hamilton apologized for her coming all that way just to see him lose. "That's why we came," she told him, "in case you lost. We didn't come in case you won." It would have been understandable, expected almost, if when Hamilton got out of his car in Abu Dhabi, he had been raging, shouting, declaiming the unfairness of it all. Like, no one would have been surprised if he had taken off his helmet and thrown it, says Hobson, or thrown the steering wheel. But that is not what Hamilton did. As his friend Tom Brady, who was standing in front of his TV, watching what he calls just the craziest of all crazy endings, observes, he handled it as gracefully as anyone possibly could imagine. There would be no public venting of any kind. Instead, Hamilton walked over to the declared victor, Verstappen, shook his hand, and congratulated him. Watching this, Lucas, a man who has a fairly notable history when it comes to the subject he was about to speak of, leaned over to Hobson and said, "Heroes are bigger than champions. Lewis just earned hero status." Hamilton learned about this comment soon after, but for a long while he couldn't really hear it. "Look, I was going through whatever emotions I was going through, so no one could say anything to me," he remembers. "It doesn't matter who. It doesn't really matter what is said. When you're feeling a certain way, sometimes it's hard to break through." But in time, he took it in. "It's one of the greatest compliments you could receive," he says. "Also, it's very, very surreal to grow up watching Star Wars and have Yoda's dad say positive things about you." Hamilton was publicly silent for several weeks after Abu Dhabi, and there was widespread speculation that he was done with racing, that he would walk away. I, for sure, considered whether I wanted to continue, he confirms. He was in a dark place, says Hobson, explaining how she had asked him to join her and Lucas for Christmas in the Caribbean. When Hamilton demurred, she told him that if he didn't come, she would go to him. In the end, he came. Everyone there was instructed not to bring up what had happened, but many mornings he and Hobson found the other awake at dawn, and that's when we spent a lot of time sort of going in and debriefing, she says. And I just kept telling him things like, we make no decisions in times of great anguish or pain. You have to just sit with this, and it's going to be hard and uncomfortable. But there's nothing to be done at this moment, so do nothing. Hobson told him that she would support him if he didn't go back, but also shared her belief that this is what you do and you're not done. The Olympic fencer Miles Chamley Watson, one of Hamilton's closest friends since they first hung out a few years ago at the Met Gala, he sat between Madonna and Rihanna, Hamilton says, and I remember looking at him, who is that? Was another of those who gathered around him after Abu Dhabi. I knew that he needed me, just as his mate, to just get him out of the mindset, Chamley Watson says, adding that he never doubted what Hamilton would do. If you know him, you know that man is not going to stop until he wants to finish. Not because somebody else made him stop. A week after our New York lunch, Hamilton and I are supposed to meet at what I've been told is one of his favorite restaurants, in the French village of Aix, not too far from his Monaco home. But arrangements somehow go awry. I've never been here before, he says, as we are led to a table at a terrace where the expansive views over the Mediterranean are breathtaking, but where he is also surrounded by unknown others in fairly close proximity. When you are as famous as Hamilton is in most of the world, you learn to avoid these situations. This is more exposed than I normally am, he notes. We'll see how it goes. As we talk, his voice is often so quiet that my recorder can barely pick it up, as though he feels constrained by the surroundings. When he orders a latte with oat milk, the waiter, seemingly baffled by his presence, asks him the awkward and fairly unanswerable question, "Is that the real you?" We talk a little about Hamilton's life. In the first half of his Formula One career, he was in a relationship with ex-Pussycat Doll singer Nicole Scherzinger for several years, their every perceived up and down relentlessly tracked by the British tabloid media. Whatever private life he has had since then, he has mostly kept to himself. I learned the hard way, he says. I learned the hard way. But then he also tells me I haven't talked about it much, that there haven't been any long relationships in recent years. I'm really just super focused on work, he says. I realized that I can't do two things or three things at once. I've got to focus on one. Furthermore, he adds, I really wanted to go through a growth process of getting myself to a point where I'm happy on my own, comfortable in my space, so that if I ever do meet someone, it's an addition rather than I need you in my life. As with most lives lived under such close scrutiny, in Hamilton's, there have been occasional wrinkles. He has long had a sturdy social media communion. His present Instagram followership is more than 29 million. But not everything has always landed as he'd hoped it might. We discuss one particularly difficult moment. On Christmas Day 2017, he posted to the world what was presumably intended as a cute and amusing 12-second video in which he sits with his nephew, who's wearing a purple and pink dress and brandishing a wand with a fluffy pink heart at its end. "Why are you wearing a princess dress?" Hamilton asked the boy, who was laughing. "Is this what you got for Christmas? Why did you ask for a princess dress for Christmas? Boys don't wear princess dresses." The world's response was swift. Hamilton was condemned for gender shaming and other insensitivities, a typical forceful riposte. Go stick your toxic masculinity up your arse. That was so stupid, he tells me, of what he did. I realized that a lot of my upbringing was coming out. I went with just an ignorant moment, and I straight away realized that that's not actually how I feel deep inside. By the next day, he had deleted the post. By the end of the week, he had deleted his entire Instagram history. I'm just not the kind of person that wants to ever hurt anybody, he says, and the idea that I could have hurt somebody through a stupid post, or just from something I said, again through ignorance, just reminded me of how I had felt from the experiences that I had had. And I was like, how am I projecting that? I realized that was wrong. And so then finding ways of not necessarily undoing it, but showing that community that I support them. It's difficult in today's world. It's difficult to undo things. Hamilton is fond of adages like, it's not how you fall, it's how you get back up. And he seems to use them less as glib catchphrases to brandish when convenient, and more as serious guides to better living. In this instance, he apologized fully and clearly for the mistake he had made and the hurt he had caused. Privately, he took it upon himself to educate himself. He posed in a kilt on the cover of British GQ, and inside gave a self-lacerating interview. He also went to Disneyland Paris with some of his extended family. Beforehand, Hamilton's nephew had asked to go to the store to buy another princess dress. I was like, let's go, says Hamilton. And that was how the two of them came to walk hand in hand, Hamilton and his nephew and his brand new dress, through Disneyland. What's crazy is, he reflects now, you have to learn something from a six-year-old. Our conversation aside, the meal here doesn't go too well. Surveying the menu, Hamilton realizes that there is more or less nothing he can eat. He orders the asparagus. Sometime later it arrives, garnished with some kind of egg and crouton topping. He patiently explains that his diet doesn't allow for this. The waiter nods, promising to return with virgin asparagus. Some further time passes before a plate of asparagus arrives. This, the waiter declares with a flourish, is without eggs. Hamilton surveys the delicately drizzled greenery placed in front of him. But, he points out with restrained politeness, it's got mayonnaise. And with that, he gives up. He drinks another latte and suggests that we go for a drive. Lewis Hamilton is behind the wheel, and I am his passenger. This experience is not entirely as you might expect. First, there's the car we are in. He knows that people expect him to have some kind of cool sports car, and he did have cars like that when he was younger. But these days, his vehicle of choice for trips like this is a tiny electric smart car made by his team's parent company, Mercedes. Second, on open roads, Hamilton is an achingly sensible and careful driver, never speeding and frequently pulling over to let impatient drivers pass. Third, as he explains, he actually doesn't like driving. Not this kind, the kind the rest of us do, with traffic in two directions, and pedestrians and junctions, and nothing clear-cut to prove. In fact, he rarely does it. I just think that I find it stressful, he says. I try not to do things that don't add to my life. And then, he adds, a statement said with sincerity, look, we're on these roads, anything can happen. After a while, we find ourselves in the outskirts of Nice, down toward the harbor. This is now stressful for me, he says. This road is crazy, so much going on here. I'm going to turn around in a second. On the racing track, he tells me, he doesn't feel fear, and he also searches out experiences like skydiving, rock climbing, and surfing. And yet, even in the most controlled minds, fear and logic may sometimes lead each other in the most unpredictable of dances. We all have our vulnerabilities. That's why, when Hamilton travels to Australia, he prefers to get a hotel room on one of the higher floors. And when he gets into the room, he will often check around the toilet. I do, he tells me. It's pathetic, but I do. The reason? Oh, God, spiders, he says. Some Australian spiders are notoriously deadly. But even if he sees a picture of a spider on a screen, Hamilton can't look at it. He credits his fear to the time as a kid when his sister made him watch the movie Arachnophobia. He knows, given everything else that he does so dauntlessly, that it might seem odd. People say, dude, you drive around at 200 miles an hour. And I'm like, in terms of fear factor, that's easy for me. I guess we're just all wired differently. Back in the mountains, well away from the city, Hamilton selects increasingly narrow and winding roads until he turns down one that seems little more than a track. I quietly wonder whether this is a terrible idea. I can see us hitting a tight dead end and having to go back out, or getting stuck entirely, but his instincts are good. We twist back and forth down the edge of a slope through a secret world of incredible houses perched above the sea. It reminds him of how a while back he went for a ride around here one night on his motorbike. He just wanted to get away from everything and ended up on a road like this. He stopped, turned off his lights, and was astonished to discover that he was surrounded by fireflies. He'd only ever seen them in animated movies. In the movie version of the Lewis Hamilton story, he would have returned this season after the painful fiasco at the end of the last, and the bloodied boxer rising from the canvas dominated every race. But it hasn't worked out like that. Every few years, Formula One teams are obliged to design almost completely new cars to a revised set of specifications. Mercedes was expected to excel at this challenge, but for 2022 it got something wrong. At high speeds, the new car repeatedly moved up and down. The cute name given to this, porpoising, belies the unpleasantness of the experience. The worst characteristic I've ever experienced in a car, Hamilton says, and its catastrophic effect on competitiveness. After he finished 13th in a race in April, chatter grew once again that he would walk away. People seemed to assume that his pride wouldn't be able to take this. In response, he was silent for a few days. Then he posted an imposing backlit image of himself in the team's tire garage with this message, "Working on my masterpiece, I'll be the one to decide when it's finished." A lot of people out there are shit talkers, he tells me. If I let those words, those projections people are putting out, those little digs, if I let that bring me down, then they win. Toward the end of May, when I join nearly 122,000 other spectators watching the Spanish Grand Prix in Barcelona, there is at least some restrained optimism around Hamilton's team that the car's worst problems have been overcome. As usual on race weekends, Hamilton spends his time not on the track, sequestered from all the crazy surrounding hullabaloo in his bubble. If this was ever just a rev-it-up-and-give-it-your-best-shot kind of sport, it is no longer. At one point, I'm taken up to glimpse the private engineering room where rows of serious-looking people, Hamilton among them, are studying data on the screens in front of them, trying to work out how to maximize every incremental advantage. Alas, the best-laid plans. On the first lap, another driver cuts too close to Hamilton and they collide. Hamilton has a puncture. He is able to change his tire, but when he rejoins the race, he is 19th. Over the team radio, he sounds momentarily disconsolate, suggesting it might be best to save the engine for another race. His team encourages him to keep pushing. Their data analysis suggests that in this improved car, he could still finish 8th and at least earn some world championship points. And from then, he flies. At times, he is the fastest driver on the track, doing once more what he has done over and over for all these years. I think he's an artist, Brady will tell me later. I think when he sees the racetrack, he sees it different than everyone else does. Like any great athlete, you have your unique way of doing things. Everyone else looks at something one way, and you look at it a different way. And you create strategies and you execute under pressure in ways that other people can't. I just think he probably sees lines on the track no one else can see. Today, Hamilton finishes fifth, but afterward he is bubbling. To do that from where he was felt like a win. I was thinking, these guys are crazy. They're smoking something, he says of the advice after the collision. There's no way I can come from 30 seconds behind dead last. Things are turning around. We're definitely going to get a win this year. That's something I couldn't have told you before the race. So it feels great. Hamilton has another year on his contract, which people have assumed may offer a natural endpoint for a driver his age who's achieved all that he has. Assume all you like. I'll be lying if I said that I hadn't thought about extending, he tells me later. Yes, he's giving extensive thought to his after-sport life and how he can fulfill a credo to, as he puts it, live to the max and live to the best of your ability. Help as many people as you can in the time that you have. But just because he's making plans for when it's over doesn't mean that it is. I'm still on the mission. I'm still loving driving. I'm still being challenged by it. So I don't really feel like I have to give it up anytime soon. Perhaps one further sign of this renewed determination is that when he vies for victory at the British Grand Prix in early July, before finishing third, he offers no public explanation for the fact that he is no longer wearing his nose stud. Anyone can have a great season, says Brady. Anyone can have five great seasons, but it's really hard to have 10 great seasons or 15 great seasons. That takes different traits, different qualities. A lot of those come from things that have happened in your life that allow you to be motivated over a long period of time. I would say, echoes Hamilton's friend Chamley Watson, he has nothing to prove, but a lot more to accomplish, and I think he's just going to keep going until the wheels fall off, literally. In truth, Hamilton is insulted that, even now, so many people might possibly mistake him for someone who would walk away from a fight. But again, he says, that's what they would do. Not him. I'm built different, he says. I mean, I was built for this. It reminds me that people still don't know me. Even after all these years, people still don't know. So, all right, I'll prove you wrong again. far from the Maddow crowd. A year ago, Rachel Maddow negotiated a staggering multi-million dollar annual deal not to be on the air five nights a week. In her first interview since stepping back, she talks Vanity Fair through her next act by Joe Pompeo with photographs by Annie Leibovitz. Opening photo, Fisher of Zinn. Rachel Maddow fly fishing on her property in Western Massachusetts, July 1st, 2022. The only reason you'll ever need this is if you fall through the ice, said Rachel Maddow, standing beside her pickup truck at an empty boat launch on a cloudy winter's day. She tossed me something that looked like a cross between a bike lock and a telephone cord and told me to put it around my neck. Safety picks. In a worst-case scenario, you're supposed to pull apart the orange handle things, stab the ice in front of you, and claw your way back onto solid ground. There's 20 inches of ice out here. You're not going to fall through, Maddow promised, but just in case. It was a Monday in early February on Maddow's home turf of Western Massachusetts. We met up in the parking lot of a frozen lake rimmed by low-slung mountains. Maddow in buffalo plaid, a baseball cap emblazoned with the logo for Yum Fishing Baits, and tortoiseshell Coke bottle glasses that the folks at home don't get to see when she's all made up for the cameras. The temperature had plunged to something like 12 degrees over the weekend, but now it was in the mid-30s, ideal for our piscatorial excursion. More than enough ice to minimize your risk of a frosty death. Warm enough to keep your hands from falling off. Maddow lives for this stuff, even as someone who grew up in sunny Castro Valley, California. Before we set off, she showed me the cozy lakefront fixer-upper she'd purchased weeks earlier with her longtime partner, the photographer Susan Mikula, about 30 minutes from the couple's 164-year-old farmhouse. We dropped by her go-to bait shop in the garage of a home boasting tattered Trump flags, where Maddow stocked up on rosy red minnows and medium shiners. Then we squeezed into our snow pants, strapped medieval-looking spikes over our boots, and trekked out onto the lake with a sled full of gear. It may be a little slushy, she said, but I promise it's fine. 1 week earlier, Maddow had knocked the wind out of her 2.4 million viewers. I'm going to go on hiatus for a little bit, she said, broadcasting on a laptop from home as opposed to her nearby studio because she just had a COVID-19 exposure. It was to Mikula, who'd already had a frightening run-in with the disease in the fall of 2020. Maddow said she had several projects in the pipeline outside of her nightly duties, including a Ben Stiller and Lorne Michaels-helmed adaptation of her 2018 podcast series, Bagman, about Spiro Agnew's Nixon-era bribery scandal, and that she needed time and space to work on them. She said she'd pop back in with special coverage as warranted, like for the State of the Union or other big news events. The largest European ground war since World War II, which would briefly disrupt Maddow's hiatus, wasn't what she had in mind. A few days later, on a Thursday, Maddow signed off from the Rachel Maddow Show for the last time until her planned return in mid-April. That Friday, she called me with an invitation to go ice fishing. And on Monday, out on the lake, as we drilled small holes and fiddled with our tip-up traps and Vexilar transducers, it's a more high-tech sport than you'd think, it occurred to Maddow that this was the first Monday in 13 years that she wasn't about to be live on air five nights a week, with no end in sight. Today's day one, she said. Maddow was embarking on a new chapter in her career, a foray into the wilds of our multi-platform media future, in which her success and influence would no longer be so neatly quantifiable. Over the next few months, we would talk a lot about what was at stake for her health and well-being and career trajectory, for her continued cultural relevance, and for the network that has long depended on her massive nightly audience. But right now, there were fish to catch. We reeled in the first one before too long. This, said Maddow, holding up our trophy, is a pickerel. This is like a typical size perfect pickerel. She released it back into the hole. Bye. See you. Ah, that was great. God and country, thank you very much. Maddow's highly rated 9 p.m. show, long the crown jewel of MSNBC primetime, if not the entire network, debuted on September 8, 2008, with a handoff from then-superstar Keith Olbermann, whose subsequent defenestration elevated Maddow to Queen Bee status. The program, known as much for its historical wonkery and sweeping monologues as its lefty bona fides, was immediately successful, but it also proved to be a massive slog. Maddow is exceptionally hands-on, and the opening of each show, the A-block in cable news parlance, requires an intensive level of preparation on a tight deadline. Someone described it to me as being like a bunch of people holed up studying for finals every night, like in a library, panic researching. Throughout the years, Maddow has usually written the A-block monologue herself, on the heels of a full day's worth of research. In October 2010, after a particularly rollicking broadcast from an historic Delaware tavern where the Maddow Show was covering a Senate showdown between Chris Coons and Christine O'Donnell, remember her, an exhausted Maddow remarked to a colleague, "A person could only do this job for 5 years." As if. Maddow, at 49, has been behind the desk for almost a decade and a half. She's been doing the job long enough that it's supremely messed up her back, which now has 7 herniated or bulging discs that she manages with physical therapy. Long enough that when she had a melanoma scare within months of Mikula ending up on death's door with COVID, it sunk in that she didn't want to be working 60 hours a week until she retires. Long enough that she had begun to worry, as she explained to me between nips from the pickerel down below, that she was losing the ability to be able to sort of have the energy and the intellectual bandwidth to do other kinds of work. And so Maddow decided it was time for a change. Last fall, she negotiated a mega deal that left jaws on the floor, a reported $30 million annually, not to be on the air 5 nights a week. Starting at some point in 2022, she'd get to do a lot less gabbing about the news cycle and a lot more premium long-form projects, podcasts, specials, documentaries, film adaptations, etc. Such is the might of Rachel Maddow that it was better for the company to lose her 4 nights a week than not to have her at all. The industry chatter is that NBC Universal gave Maddow an enormous raise, only to seat her in the key primetime block that remains incredibly vital to ratings, advertisers, and cable subscriptions. Words thrown around in my conversations with industry hotshots, most of whom think Maddow's great, by the way, include ridiculousness, so nuts, and stupidest deal ever. NBC Universal News Group chairman Cesar Conde strongly disputes those characterizations, telling me in a phone interview, "We only do things that make sense for us strategically or financially. The primary focus for us was, how do we come up with a structure of what we need and want from Rachel, and also what she needs going forward?" Phil Griffin, the former longtime president of MSNBC, who remains one of Maddow's closest advisors, acknowledged it was hard to lose her every night, but said, "The way she works is so demanding. We were lucky to get 14 years out of her." After Maddow's 9-week sabbatical, she returned to The Rachel Maddow Show on April 11th and made it official for her viewers. They'd have her 4 nights a week through the end of the month, and then, starting in May, "I'm going to be here weekly. I'm going to be here on Monday nights." Thus began the next act of Rachel Maddow, whose power was undeniable even to her naysayers, of whom there are many. As Maddow critic Eric Wimple observed on his Washington Post blog, Rachel Maddow can do whatever she pleases. It's hard to overstate Maddow's value to MSNBC over the past 14 years. In the wake of Olbermann's firing, she became the face of the network's primetime roster, the touchstone of everything we do, as her colleague Joy Reid puts it. MSNBC's other crown jewel, Morning Joe, is the network's power center, commanding influence within the establishment corridors of New York and Washington. Maddow, you might say, sets the network's ideological agenda, a signifier for the entire MSNBC brand. Her broad, progressive appeal and singular approach to anchoring, story-driven monologues that run as long as 30 minutes, connecting dots you never knew existed, and dragging viewers down any number of rabbit holes, have made her MSNBC's number one celebrity and perennial ratings champ, the only figure in non-Murdochian cable news who can play in the same sandbox as the fire breathers at Fox. She has at times eked out wins over rival Sean Hannity, while keeping CNN's rotating cast of 9 p.m. host in third place, often distantly, ever since the Rachel Maddow show started to regularly trounce Larry King Live more than a decade ago. During the first week of her hiatus this past February, the 9 p.m. audience plummeted 26% and stayed down for weeks before soaring back above 2 million upon her April 11th return. According to data from Moffitt Nathanson, Maddow's ratings share in 2021, 11% of MSNBC's total ratings, was higher than that of any other solo host in all of cable. This popularity has naturally made her a target. On the extreme end of the spectrum, there's the hate mail and death threats, which she says haven't abated, even though she's no longer on TV as much. Then there are the requisite recriminations from the right, which regards her with the same contempt that liberals harbor for personalities like Hannity and Tucker Carlson. But even among non-enemy combatants, it's not as if Maddow is universally beloved. Typical criticisms are that she can be snarky, obnoxious, pedantic. On a practical level, her thoroughly complex monologues simply aren't for everyone, and the payoff doesn't always justify the windup. In March 2017, Maddow took blowback for hyping what seemed like a holy grail-level scoop about Trump's taxes, which she teased out in a suspenseful 20-minute opener. She finally revealed a single federal payment from two pages of Trump's 2005 return, obtained by her guest that evening, the journalist David K. Johnston. The much-maligned segment, to be fair, was the spark that ignited a landmark New York Times investigation that did manage to unearth the motherlode of Trump's tax returns. As Times reporter Susanna Craig explained during an appearance on Maddow's show the following year. Next, photo history making. Maddow in her home office, where she's polishing a new World War II era podcast series expected to debut this autumn. Whatever her detractors think, Maddow remains a sui generis star in the media firmament, which explains the breathless interest in her career machinations. Intrigue began swirling last summer with leaks that Maddow was thinking about leaving the network for new opportunities. Before long, news broke that Maddow, after months of discussions quarterbacked by her super agents at Endeavor, would be sticking with NBC Universal after all. She'd secured a new multi-year contract to pursue projects in a wide range of formats, from documentaries and streaming specials to movies and books, all under the banner of her newly minted independent production company, whose name I can now reveal, Surprise Inside. Maddow would conceive the projects, and NBC would get first right of refusal. The Rachel Maddow Show would eventually go weekly, and she would continue to do specials for the network, but she would have a lot more flexibility. It was the Daily Beast that pegged her annual compensation at $30 million. Maddow wouldn't comment on any of this. I'm legally restrained from discussing the terms of my contract, other than to dispute the reported $30 million. Someone else with direct knowledge of the matter told me Maddow's full package is worth more when you add a separate overhead and development deal. She also specified that she hadn't yet signed the new contract when news outlets reported on it. Through my own reporting, I was able to piece together how it all went down. The story begins about 2 years prior, when Endeavor CEO Ari Emanuel and President Mark Shapiro began actively pursuing her. They'd wanted to sign her for a while, and they were even more motivated to do so after Bagman became a hit. Maddow was willing to hear them out because her beloved longtime agent, Gene Sage, of the much smaller Napoli Management Group, had signaled her intention to retire. Emanuel and Shapiro first met with her in November 2019 at an apartment on the west side of Manhattan, where they gave Maddow the hard sell on working with them to grow her career across the media spectrum. She wasn't ready to make any moves just yet, super loyal to Sage, but Endeavor kept in touch, kept talking, and eventually, as the expiration of Maddow's contract began to poke out over the horizon, the stars aligned. Sage was ready to take a bow, and Endeavor promised to do the right thing by cutting Napoli in on any deal they struck. By now, it was mid-2021. Shapiro started taking meetings all over town, a couple of which Maddow joined. They talked to Netflix, they talked to Amazon, they talked to Spotify, Showtime, CNN. Jeff Zucker, president of CNN at the time, toyed with the idea of hiring Maddow for the network's ill-fated streaming service, CNN Plus. The brass surmised that having Maddow from a liberal network and Chris Wallace from conservative Fox News would give the platform a certain range. But Maddow's agents balked at the proposed salary in the $10 to $15 million range, according to people who know the numbers. There was a much bigger opportunity on the table. Sirius XM was poised to offer Maddow closer to $40 million, plus a first-look deal, sources told me. Sirius had no comment. The idea was that she could do a weekday talk show and still pursue all of her other creative projects. This wouldn't free Maddow from the daily grind, but it was a tempting proposition. She had a lot to think about. Amid these flirtations, Condé had two options: give Maddow the freedom she craved, or risk losing one of the company's most important talents. Someone plugged into the talks assured me that before NBC landed on a number, they worked through the economics and finances of it in terms of the output they could expect from Maddow in her new multi-platform role and what that would mean to the bottom line. The talks unfolded in two stages. First, Condé reached an agreement on the specifics of what Maddow's job would entail. Then Jimmy Horowitz, who oversees global deal-making for NBC Universal's film and television portfolio, negotiated the salary. Once the deal was a fait accompli, Maddow's colleagues breathed a sigh of relief. "I'm just glad she's staying in any capacity," says Reed. "We all felt that kind of pit-in-the-stomach panic." Ditto Chris Hayes. "The fact that she's not leaving makes it feel less seismic. If it was like, oh, now she's at CNN, it would be different." By all accounts, working for the Maddow Show can be extremely demanding. It's a tight-knit and deeply loyal staff. Going from 5 days a week with Maddow to one day must feel like a bit of a bummer. Maddow's longtime executive producer, Corey Nazzo, who will continue to shepherd her live MSNBC appearances, acknowledged, "It's a challenging time. Change is difficult. We've been doing this, most of us, for many years. We're used to producing for Rachel, so it's a challenge for us to produce for someone else." Maddow opened up about the whole process while we fished. It wasn't some sort of like hostile, heated negotiation with NBC, she said. What I ask for, and I realize it's a really hard thing to ask for from a big corporate entity, is flexibility, fluidity, and forgiveness. Like, I want us to handle this in a way that we don't have to map every second of it. And I want my staff to all stay employed. And I want them to be able to shift between different types of projects, just as I am. Did she think they would agree to all of that? No, said Maddow. I don't know anybody who's ever asked for it. It's potentially higher risk, higher reward, right? I think writ large, if they ended up with, like, a hit award-winning podcast, and a hit movie, and a docuseries, and a serial TV show, and I'm covering the State of the Union, and some of the time I'm doing the Rachel Maddow show, that's probably a better deal for them, long run, than me just doing TRMS and killing myself and not being able to do anything, and ultimately having a shorter career because I'm burning myself out. Like, I'm not becoming a painter. Nonetheless, you can see why Maddow's retreat from the nightly schedule is a pickle for the suits at 30 Rock. In late June, the network announced that Alex Wagner would take over Maddow's crucial hour Tuesday to Friday, starting August 16th, making her the only Asian American to host a primetime cable news program. Wagner had hosted a daytime MSNBC show before it was canceled in 2015. But she made a comeback with gigs at CBS News and Showtime's The Circus with John Heilman. Wagner joined MSNBC this past February as a senior analyst and substitute anchor, which positioned her for the elevation to 9 p.m. To say she's got a tall order would be an understatement, but MSNBC President Rashida Jones doesn't see it that way. The universe is very different from when Rachel joined the cable news spectrum. My focus is less about how does this 1 hour perform in this one space, she tells me. It's a huge change. But in this environment, where we know the cable universe is changing, this allows us to get more Rachel in more places. Changing, indeed, with viewers increasingly unmoored from their traditional cable packages, MSNBC's linear television business was in a dicey position, even without the headache of losing a ratings powerhouse 4 nights a week. In the words of one cable news veteran, remember when print was dying, but online was not quite yet what it is now? That's where cable news is. So the existential question is not Rachel Maddow, it's MSNBC. Maddow's view of the industry is less fatalistic, if a bit jaded. It has sort of been like Chronicle of a Death foretold the whole time I've been doing cable news, she told me. Stuff changes at the executive level, and stuff changes in terms of who's up and who's down, which network's winning, which host is hot. But ultimately, does anything really change that much? I noted the lack of an obvious successor, whereas Maddow had been the natural successor to Olbermann. That's how it works in retrospect, she countered, but in the moment, it's much harder to see. Like, Tucker's doing great right now, as in Carlson of Fox News. But look at Tucker's career. The first show I worked on was his 11 o'clock show on MSNBC that nobody remembers. But he was always kicking around the business and has always been talented. This turned out to be his moment. It may surprise people to hear Maddow speak so matter-of-factly about someone whose views are abhorrent to her, but Maddow has never shied from respectful engagement with her ideological adversaries. The early days of her MSNBC program featured amiable debates with Pat Buchanan. She was friendly with Roger Ailes, who blurbed one of her books. She told Stephen Colbert in 2019 that she had a lot of respect for Sean Hannity. It was Carlson who gave Maddow her first paid TV gig when she began appearing on MSNBC's Tucker back in 2005. Carlson spoke admiringly of her in a 2019 New York Times Magazine profile, and when his name came up as we fished, Maddow recalled bumping into him at an event for the first time in a long time, It was really nice to see him, she said. A few months later, I asked Maddow what she thought of the Times recent series that unpacked how Fox News Channel's number one host weaponizes his viewers' fears and grievances to create what may be the most racist show in the history of cable news. What Maddow found most interesting about the series, she told me, was an interactive analyzing Carlson's rhetoric from 1,150 episodes of Tucker Carlson Tonight. For me, she said, more than the issue of, you know, how dangerous are Tucker's ideas and how do they interact with the growth of the authoritarian right in the Republican Party, more so than that question, which is obviously what the central thrust of the reporting was about, I was interested in how they deconstructed why it works. Rather than engaging on Carlson's politics, Maddow talks about him and other cable news rivals as fellow practitioners. If you think about baseball players, she said, who are extremely competitive and who are fighting to win and who have rivalries, and some of those rivalries are bitter rivalries, that doesn't mean you don't study the pitching technique of their star pitcher. It doesn't mean you don't appreciate whatever they're doing in terms of, you know, where they put their shortstop in order to give them a better defense. There's a sort of, like, respecting the game in terms of people who are doing well and people who are good at it. I mean, that was the basis of my professional friendship with Roger Ailes. I wanted tips from him about how to be better on TV, and he was willing to talk to me about what I was doing well and doing poorly to help me get better. Of course, Maddow being great on TV can't neutralize Trump conspiracy theories or save democracy. The stakes of this competition are significantly higher than a World Series ring. Maddow had been in the business for about a decade by the time she truly began to cultivate an audience. This was back in 2008, when Griffin gave Maddow her own show. 9 years earlier, she'd retreated from London to Western Massachusetts to finish her dissertation for Oxford, where she'd been a Rhodes Scholar. Since her teen years in California's Bay Area, filled with volleyball tournaments and swim meets and the emotional cliff dive, as Maddow put it, of coming out at 17 during her freshman year at Stanford, Maddow had been a passionate and driven activist for the AIDS crisis, the subject of her doctoral research. If you'd have asked anyone from her inner circle back then, that's where they thought Maddow was headed professionally. Then, on a whim, she won a contest to host a local radio show. It was just hilarious, says Chuck Bayless, one of Maddow's oldest friends. None of us could have ever guessed this trajectory. Local radio led to Air America, which led to regular appearances on MSNBC, which led to a political analyst gig, which led to substitute hosting for Countdown with Keith Olbermann. And finally, just 2 months before Barack Obama's historic election, Maddow's own hour as Olbermann's lead-in. In our very first show meeting, she said, I want to do a 15 to 20 minute opening, recalls Griffin, who's now working with Maddow to build Surprise Inside. And I went, whoa, that's radical. So I said, okay, let's see if it works. She did that first day. She beat Larry King, virtually unheard of at the time, and she created something brand new. Those epic openers continue to distinguish Maddow's now weekly show. In a 17-minute, 26-second monologue that kicked off the May 16th episode, 2 days after 10 African Americans were gunned down by a white supremacist inside a Buffalo supermarket, Maddow gave viewers a long and winding history lesson that stretched back to the 1940s. When a fascist mob set upon black workers in Detroit, and Theodore Bilbo embraced the now ubiquitous Great Replacement Theory during his Senate re-election campaign. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones. Reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.